And this is our second-to-last episode here, episode 51 for September 18th, 2007. And we're going to get started today by the first of two-part segment on Westerns, where Sam will talk about the classic Western film and what it's all about. I will have a trivia question for Sam this week, and then we're going to follow it up with a Film Buff's Dictionary entry about the cinematographer or director of photography, depending on where you are. Our top six list is going to be one that I had trouble with, and it's the top six performances by directors. And speaking of great directors, we're going to finish it with a director spotlight on Howard Hawks, one of the all-time greatest Hollywood directors. I'm Stephen Keller.
And I'm Sam Stoddard, and you get off my land, you rootin' tootin' consarn horse thieves. I'll have your horse whipped.
Did you take some sort of aging potion again, Sam?
Oh, yeah, I gotta stop doing that. It's a bad habit.
All right, so we're joined today by Sam's great-great-great-great-grandfather, a Civil War veteran and a retired gunslinger who's going to get called back for one last job, right?
Pew, pew, pew!
As always, high-quality sound effects here at All Movie Talk.
We're going to be talking a bit about the Western this week and next, and this is one of the first movie genres, actually. I mean, 1903's The Great Train Robbery by Edwin S. Porter, kind of the first real movie, putting real in quotes. I mean, it's the first movie that feels like, you know, it's got a story, it's got a few different scenes, and it is a real breakthrough, and it's a Western. It has a lot of the hallmarks of the genre in place. It has a heist and a shootout and masked bandits and everything. And it wasn't too much longer before the other staples of the genre emerged. I mean, you got the gunfights and everything. Now you add in saloons and poker and girls and whiskey, and you've got all the trappings. It sounds like a pretty decadent genre when I put it that way, but I'll get to that in a minute. So why was the Western so popular all of a sudden? Well, if you think about it today, you're probably asking that question because it does maybe seem arbitrary that early movies latched on to this particular setting, this particular period in history, and used it as the environment for just an endless number of action movies, and then comedies, and then later character dramas, and all sorts of things. I mean, it's a genre that does mix well with other genres. There's science fiction westerns and musical westerns and so on. Well, for starters, this time and place didn't used to be as far removed as it is now. I mean, most westerns figure they're probably set between 1860 and 1890. The Great Train Robbery was made in 1903. I mean, it's not that far off. You think of Napoleon Dynamite, a recent movie set in the 80s. That is further removed from its time period than The Great Train Robbery was from the Old West, the Golden Age of the Old West. Of course, it was filmed in New Jersey, so the geography isn't quite right, but, you know, whatever. Although a lot of the early westerns were set in the present day, too, so it's not like the Old West ended in 1890 or so. You do have westerns set in the present day, made in the 40s. You know, a little weird to see Roy Rogers on Trigger chasing down the bad guys as they race around in their car. But the point is, you know, the Old West was very much alive when these movies are being made. And so it was a way of life that people understood, I think, a lot better than they do now. The other thing is, what genres compete with the Western? You know, like Toy Story, Buzz Lightyear possibly supplanting Woody as the favorite toy. So science fiction, fantasy, horror maybe in some cases. Well, if you were a boy in the 1920s and you wanted to go to a pulpy matinee or something, you weren't going to be seeing German expressionism, okay? Science fiction, fantasy, horror, they weren't quite realized in this country at that point yet. You were going to go to a Western and you're going to see the lone sheriff riding fast horses and shooting the bad guys off cliffs and stuff like that. And in fact, the earliest Westerns are mostly adventure stories for kids. B-movies almost always, just really cheap things they could film really quickly. A whole generation of Western stars from that time that have been forgotten today. Names like Tom Mix. Do you know that name? I bet you don't. But he was the first big Western superstar. Made over 300 Westerns mostly in the 1920s. Hoot Gibson is another one. Great names here. Buck Jones. These guys each had their little trademarks kind of to distinguish him from the others, because the movies weren't really distinguished from each other. But, you know, I don't remember which is which, but one, for example, would always wear the guns, these ivory-handled guns, of course. He'd have two guns in his holsters with the handles facing forward, so when he would draw on the bad guys, he'd cross his arms and the right arm would get the left gun and vice versa, and he'd whip them out at the same time. That was his trademark move. Another guy would use his left hand to cock the gun as his right hand was firing, so he'd fire really fast that way. And these were all trademarks that just, kids just kind of latched onto as just being kind of a cool thing. And, you know, they were made in large part for kids. And these movies are actually largely responsible. You know, you have the stereotype, okay, the good guy always wears white and rides a white horse and is nice and clean and has gleaming teeth, and the bad guys always wear black and ride black horses and have weather-beaten faces and scowl a lot and drink too much, and those would be the bad guys. And these movies kind of conform to that idea. You know, this Dudley Do-Right parodies that idea. Blake Edwards' film The Great Race does the same thing, where Tony Curtis is the gleaming hero dressed all in white, and he can walk leisurely through a huge pie fight and not get hit because, you know, he can't get dirty. He's the good guy. This is where that comes from, that idea. So fun movies for audiences of the day, but not necessarily enduring through the ages. But they do set up an important thing, actually. That is that Westerns are largely going to be morality plays of some sort. Not pretentious about it, probably. We are trying to be escapist here, but something to do with right and wrong. The good guy is always going to win, but he's not going to do it by resorting to the evil tricks that the bad guys will use. I mean, he's never going to kill anybody except in self-defense. And he's going to be trusting of people, even if they're not trustworthy. He's always going to be a gentleman. So this is interesting because as the Westerns age through the 1930s, they're going to become more and more A movies rather than B movies. They're going to mature and become more directed toward adults, probably still suitable for kids and of interest to kids, but they're not going to be addressing kids specifically quite so much. And the moral lines are going to become trickier to navigate, but at the same time, almost all the great classic Westerns are still going to be morality plays of some kind. The hero trying to figure out how to do the right thing. The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, about a politician who lets a myth about him live on despite that he knows it's not true. How much of that is right or wrong? It's not exactly lying, but it's not exactly honest either. High Noon, about a guy standing up for justice when no one else will stand with him, and that's a scary thing. The Oxbow Incident, about these killers who are caught by an angry posse who just want to hang them on the spot, and one guy tries to stand up and say, hey, no, we need to have them stand a fair trial, and of course he's accused of siding with the enemy. So, difficult situations to do the right thing, but, you know, a lot of these Westerns are about that dilemma. And the Western is the perfect setting, really, if you think about it, for those kinds of stories, because the law is not an established institution in the untamed wild, wild West. It's still being settled, still being civilized, untamed world, except for these little towns that might have a sheriff out on his own, or maybe he has a deputy. If you shoot him, you can go in and rob the bank, and no one will stop you, you know? And if the law itself is corrupt, so much the more difficult to do the right thing and live a peaceful life. You know, this is a place and time where it's a lot easier to escape having to answer for your actions, and a great place to explore the moral and ethical questions that come up in that environment. And consequently, a great place to establish heroes that you can look up to, the guy who does stand up and upholds a code of honor of some kind. It's also important to know that these were not made in the 1800s. They were made in the 1940s, in the 1950s, the 30s, whatever, and address what was going on in American history, what the questions we had on our minds. We had a lot of ethical questions dealing with, for example, the Great Depression, World War II, the Cold War, at the end of the classic Western period, maybe Vietnam. How better, really, to talk about how you're going as a nation than to set a story in a formative time in where we were going as a nation, you know, the settling of the Old West. So, Western's a great place to wrap all that heavy thinking up, but in an escapist kind of wrapper, because you do have the shootouts, you got the horses and the saloons and striking gold and all these kind of things that are fun, adventurous stuff that complement the moral part of the question really well. So, as I say, the matinee type of westerns gave way to bigger mainstream Hollywood productions in the 30s. You get Cimarron winning the Best Picture Oscar for 1931, and I actually hate that movie, but it's a great example of Hollywood starting to pour its top talents and best money into the western and giving it some prestige and showing off some spectacle with it instead of just relegating it to B-movies. And later on in the decade, you have Stagecoach in 1939, which I think is the first really artistic masterpiece in this genre. I think it showed a lot of people how you could really make great art with it and not just a great adventure. You could do both. And that's followed by a huge parade of great Western films. I mean, we've talked a lot about the John Ford Westerns recently, My Darling Clementine, She Wore a Yellow Ribbon. We're going to talk about the Howard Hawks Westerns in a little later in this episode, Red River and Rio Bravo. Another director, mostly in the 50s, Anthony Mann, started making great Westerns with Jimmy Stewart as the star. Winchester 73 and The Naked Spur, they made a bunch together, and surprisingly gritty and tense for something you might think of as being a typical 50s movie. It's kind of raw and violent, and I think Mann was interested in the thriller side of the genre, and he was interested in casting Stewart as this guy who just wants to live his life in peace, but ultimately gets dragged into using violence and force and taking charge to defend his life and his way of life. So it's like all of a sudden filmmakers were interested in making great, exciting action-adventure stories as Westerns, and having things to say through them in the process, and figuring out how to balance those two things. In parallel, we still did have a lot of B-movies that were Westerns. They did not wane in popularity. Changed a little with the advent of sound, though. One interesting thing is the sudden popularity of the so-called singing cowboy. A lot of the B-Westerns became musicals. So you had Gene Autry and Roy Rogers, lesser-known guys like Rex Allen and Tex Ritter. The movies they made were actually a lot like 20s Westerns, but they had these breaks for song. So a lot of harmonizing around the campfires, the heroes serenading the girl, very pleasant kinds of movies. For a while, songs of the open trails, you know, were pretty popular and on the radio a lot, and that kind of diminished through the 50s. But with the 50s, widescreen really fit well. The Westerns and their wide-open desert landscapes. Widescreen came about in around 1952 or so, and you started to see epic Westerns, like The Searchers. And in the 60s, we got How the West Was Won, which is a three-hour or so collaboration of a few big directors, including Henry Hathaway and John Ford, who were both made a name on great Westerns. Shane wasn't that long or filmed in widescreen, but it feels like it was. It feels like an epic, a real icon of a movie starring Alan Ladd, who, this is his best-known role as Shane, but he actually was in an awful lot of Westerns. And it's a great working of an idea that Westerns explored a lot. This gunslinger who has miraculously lived long enough to regret and renounce that way of life. And he just wants to settle down and start a new life and leave all that stuff behind him, but circumstances don't let him do that. He's drawn back into that way. A lot of great Westerns have dealt with this. Everything from The Gunfighter with Gregory Peck to Unforgiven with Clint Eastwood. What is it about this? I wonder if you know. What's so compelling about this idea that so many great movies are made from it?
Yeah, I mean, it's not just the Western either. I mean, the guy who gets drawn back into the life he tried to escape is a pretty common theme in stories, period, and particularly in the movies. But I think part of it is that it speaks directly to us. I mean, we all have things we think we've left behind and then find out we can't quite leave them behind. Like they say, Magnolia, we may be through with the past, but the past ain't through with us. I think that's just a common human theme, the idea that we can't escape our past or that it's somehow going to continue to haunt us. And it works particularly well in the Western because you can have this really, really violent past, and it's believable that a person who might be an okay guy could have a super violent past, so we can identify with them. You know, if you set it in the modern setting and you have this guy who's a, you know, essentially a hired killer or something, you can't believe that he's also a really good guy, because in today's world, good people don't go into that kind of line of work. But I think in the Old West, it's a little more believable. We could believe that someone who's kind of really deep down a sensitive soul, like Clint Eastwood in Unforgiven or like in Shane, we could believe that those people might, you know, just have taken a life of violence because that was the norm in the Old West, or at least in the movie version of the Old West.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I guess, you know, I'm thinking about it, this goes back to novels by Joseph Conrad and as far forward as, well, I think David Cronenberg made a movie along those lines. Anyway, another interesting thing about 50s Westerns is I think they start to become a bit more socially conscious. Just as a blanket rule of thumb, it might be irresponsible to say for the amount of exceptions there may be, but I think 40s Westerns tend to be about personal codes of honor. 50s Westerns, still about that, but skewing a little more towards community, our connection with other people. For one thing, Westerns don't stereotype the Indians quite so much in the 50s. In 1950, actually, the movie Broken Arrow, and there's absolutely no relation with the John Woo movie, but that has Jimmy Stewart in a Western that really empathizes with the Native Americans and portrays them as real people and tells a story about people who don't understand them and attack them without really having good reason. So it's in large part about prejudice against Native Americans. And of course, a few years later, John Ford's The Searchers would deal directly with racism in a pretty complex kind of way. But then you can also think of other types of social communal situations that Westerns dealt with, like The Blacklist. You know, we'll mention in a moment when we talk about Howard Hawks how High Noon and Rio Bravo are sort of about the Blacklist era that was going on at the time. There's a movie from the 50s also called Bad Day at Black Rock, starring Spencer Tracy as a one-armed man. And actually, it's kind of funny, they made him a one-armed character so as to make sure that Spencer Tracy would be interested in the role when he was asked. They figured, who's going to pass up the chance to play a one-armed guy? So they got Spencer Tracy, and he's a stranger in town, and it turns out that, oh gosh, the whole town seems to be pretty cold toward him. And apparently they're hiding some secret that they're going to go to any lengths to protect, and they're suspicious of strangers. They don't welcome them at all, and Spencer Tracy's thinking, ah, geez, what kind of place is this? And it's dealing with closeted evils and the kind of things that happen to a community rather than on an individual level, and that's a great film. So it's interesting how the Western genre evolves with the times. We'll talk more about this next week. But just speaking generally about the classic Western, I think it is actually important, if you love movies, to go back to the great Westerns of the 40s and 50s, because I think today we've lost touch with that a little bit. We've become disconnected from not just the movies, but the times and the values they were made with. And I think now we, you know, talking to people who aren't too familiar with the Westerns, it seems like their impression of the Western comes from those 1920s Westerns where the good guy's always in white and the bad guy's always in black, and they just spend time shooting at each other until somebody dies. And those can be fun, but they are pretty simplistic, and they're not at all representative of the incredible diversity of characters and plot situations and genres and stuff that the Western can cover, and the great range of ideas that you can express through a good Western adventure that's also a really fun action thriller of some sort. So, check out some of these that we've mentioned from the 40s and 50s and late 30s, early 60s. And, you know, if you're not too familiar with classic Westerns, I think you might be surprised how much they grab you, and you'll start being one of those people that, oh, I don't like Westerns except for these eight that I've seen. So that's my hope, anyway. Next week, we'll be talking about the revisionist Westerns and the sort of the second age of Westerns that started in the late 60s, where things really changed for this genre and the way they were made. So check back with us next week.
We've been talking about Westerns, so I think I'd go with a fairly little-known Western. But I'll see if you can tell me what is interesting about this film, Sam, for our trivia question today. It was a 1938 film called The Terror of Tiny Town. And if you know about Westerns or about obscure, strange movies, you probably know that this one has something very interesting and unique about it. So we'll come back a little bit later in the episode and see if you can tell me what that is. This film bus dictionary segment really could have gone in our cinematographic... Yeah, I think I kind of got that right. sequence, but we're going to do it here now, where we're sort of talking about some different jobs in the movie industry. And it's another one of those things where I don't think this guy here, the cinematographer, also known as the director of photography, or just the DP for director of photography, maybe the person doesn't get a lot of credit a lot of times, when in fact, the cinematographer is probably the person who has the most control over the actual look of a film, right after the director, of course, who, you know, he's the big shot. But in fact, a lot of directors are not that technical, not even that visual necessarily. They are more interested in plot and pacing, that kind of thing. So in that case, the cinematographer gets a whole lot of control over the way the movie looks. So the cinematographer, basically, his duties can be broken down into two different categories. One is that he's the head of lighting on the set. And I guess actually this differs a little bit between British and American filmmaking. I think most of the world uses it sort of the way America does, where the cinematographer is the head of both lighting and camera stuff. I guess in Britain, oftentimes these are sort of separate jobs, which is kind of interesting. But here in America, generally, the cinematographer is going to be head of all the lighting. So he's going to control what lights get used, where they're put, what type of light they are, and obviously in terms of if we're shooting outdoors, you know, we still usually bring light with us, even if it's outdoors. You might have to set up reflectors, get different light, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, doing things like controlling the colors of lights, putting gels on lights. I mean, obviously setting up lighting is extremely important for the look of a movie. Like you know, I've mentioned before, without light you don't have a movie, so much of photography is all about controlling light. So that's one of the main duties of the cinematographer. And often that stuff is all very, very technical, and a lot of directors do not understand all of that. You know, they might be more comfortable with ideas like setting up shots and composition of a shot, but when it comes to all the nitty-gritty details of lighting, they're probably going to be generally letting the cinematographer be in charge of that. And like we mentioned before, you know, the cinematographer is going to be the, sort of the boss of the various electrical people on a set, the people who actually set up the lights. Now, the director of photography also is in charge of the camera. Now, he's not usually the guy actually operating the camera. The cameraman or camera operator does that, but he is usually, the cinematographer is usually in charge of that person. And not only is he in charge of the camera operator, the cinematographer is in charge of what kind of film stock we're going to be using, though usually there's not a whole lot of choice there necessarily, but what kind of lenses are going to be used for a shot. A lot of times, you know, this is something that a director and a director of photography will sit down and discuss in advance. We talked about before, Sidney Lumet, when he was filming 12 Angry Men, had this whole concept of a lens strategy, where he was going to use one kind of lens and one kind of camera angle at the beginning and then gradually switch as the movie went on. So a director might collaborate with the cinematographer to get all that in advance. But oftentimes you shoot the same scene from multiple setups with multiple lenses, and so it's going to be the cinematographer who's going to often have control over that, control over things like the aperture setting, any filters that get placed over the lens, all that kind of technical stuff the cinematographer is in charge of. And he's also usually in charge of actually setting up the shot in terms of what angle we're shooting from, how we're composing the scene, how do you arrange the elements within the single frame. So really the cinematographer, like I said, has just a tremendous amount of control and influence over the final look of the film. I mean, you think about it, you control lighting, you control where the camera is and what lenses are being used and how the camera is set up. Well, you've pretty much just determined exactly how the movie is going to look. Cinematographer is also the guy who's going to, if we're doing a traveling shot, he might very well work to help script exactly how that's going to work. If we're going to zoom in at this point in time, you know, he's going to maybe suggest that to the director, the different ways of working with it. And, of course, different directors have different ways of working with their cinematographers. I'm sure somebody like Barry Sonnenfeld, who is a former cinematographer himself, when he's directing, I'm sure he's got an exact idea of what kind of technical stuff he wants to do. Whether you get other directors, I've heard like Kevin Smith, who everyone kind of criticizes for making really flat-looking movies. You know, he says he admits to being a horrible photographer and really just being a writer who ended up making movies through sort of a strange method. He's like, I just let my cinematographers do whatever the heck they want. I don't try to get in their way, basically. I just want them to capture my words correctly. So really going to run the whole gamut. There'll be some directors who give absolutely no creative control to the cinematographers. They're going to be involved in everything because they're super technical and know exactly what they like. And then there are other people who are more like Kevin Smith, especially, you know, if they happen to have come not from more technical backgrounds, from writing or acting, that kind of stuff, they might very well allow cinematographers to control how the shot looks a lot more heavily. So yeah, an important thing to see. You'll see the cinematographers all the time, and I think one of the things that you start doing as you begin appreciating movies more and more is to start noticing the effect that different cinematographers have on a movie. Here's a good exercise. Find some of your favorite-looking movies. Look who the cinematographers are. Go use the IMDb. You can find it in the more credits section. Find out who shot the movie and see what else they've done. And maybe see if you can learn a little bit about the individual styles of cinematographers. It's a very, very interesting subject. And I think, sadly, it sometimes gets the short shrift. We end up talking just about directors and kind of everyone gets pushed aside a little bit. But a very interesting job and a very important one. This week's top six list is all about directors acting. We're going to kind of, since I had a real hard time compiling this list despite the fact that it was my idea, we're going to go ahead and kind of combine a little two different things. So you're going to either pick a director who is acting in one of his own films, or a director who is acting in somebody else's films, with the caveat that he shouldn't be mainly an actor, so no fair picking Sean Penn's performance in Fast Times at Ridgemont High just because Penn's directed a few movies. He's still primarily an actor. So hopefully this is not too complex, because I'm going to get started with it right now, and you'll hopefully follow along as we go. So my sixth pick is Martin Scorsese from his cameo in his own film Taxi Driver. He plays the crazy passenger that Travis Bickle, played by Robert De Niro, picks up, who kind of encourages Bickle to go on the insane cleansing shooting spree that later on will motivate the rest of the movie. It's a cool moment. Scorsese, just a wild character of a guy anyway. Half the time you see him interviewed, he reminds me kind of somebody like Quentin Tarantino, another director we might be talking about in a moment, who has that so much energy and just really, really crazy and nuts. And plus, he has those eyebrows, man. Those eyebrows do half the acting for him. memorable scene, and you know, it's kind of cool and fun.
You're right. He is a character. I don't know that he has necessarily a big range of acting. Who knows? I haven't seen him attempt a range. But in a small character moment like that, where all he needs to do is be his usual hyperactive self, it works perfectly. So good pick there. Number six for me is going to be John Cassavetes. Now, this is a guy that is called the father of modern independent cinema or something along those lines. And he started out acting, actually, but I thought it was a fair pick here because he is primarily known now as a director. And in 1967, he was established as an independent film director, but he still continued to act, and in 1967, he made a movie called The Dirty Dozen by director Robert Aldrich. And The Dirty Dozen is a great movie, I think, one I'm glad to finally get around to talking about. There's just a wonderful assortment of tough guy characters. I mean, it's a dozen of them, about, more or less. I mean, Lee Marvin, Ernest Borgnine, Charles Bronson, George Kennedy. If you know these people, you know that probably John Cassavetes is, you know, you wouldn't necessarily lump him in with this tough crew, but he does a great job in this movie.
Well, speaking of tough guys, Quentin Tarantino, huh? A director who does a lot of acting and other people's stuff, though I normally find him a little annoying as an actor, but boy, in Pulp Fiction, in 1994, a movie he directed and wrote, playing Jimmy, the guy whose wife is going to get a divorce. No, not a trial separation, not marriage counseling, a straight to a divorce. If she finds them, a couple gangsters in her living room doing gangster stuff with the dead body blown apart in the car. Tarantino, like I mentioned before when I mentioned Scorsese, a character in and of himself, one of these super hyperactive guys who can't ever seem to shut up. But here he's playing a character who's supposed to be insane and hyperactive and really kind of annoying. And his rants about, of course I know it's good coffee, Jules, I bought it my... It's a funny role. And originally Tarantino was going to play the drug dealer. The role ended up going to Eric Stoltz. And thank goodness, because I couldn't even imagine that big dramatic overdose scene if Tarantino is hamming it up. But as Jimmy, one of my favorite moments from one of my favorite movies, Pulp Fiction 1994.
Wow, I can't believe you picked Tarantino. You're right, that is one of his least annoying performances, and I would even say one of his most appropriate performances, but I don't think he'd make my list anyway. Well, I can see why you did, though, actually. Number five for me is Sidney Pollack. Now, this is the director of films such as Out of Africa, and the recent The Interpreter, a political thriller that I quite liked. but he also does quite a bit of acting, and I actually thought of three different performances I could have picked for this list, including his one for The Interpreter, also his performance in Woody Allen's Husband and Wives, but I finally had to settle on something maybe a bit more obscure. It's a supporting performance in the movie Changing Lanes, a recent movie with Ben Affleck and Samuel L. Jackson, and I really like the movie. It's about a couple of guys who just can't let anything go, and they start bickering, and then the argument escalates into a ridiculously cruel conflict, and what interested me about it is how either one of them could have stopped it at any time, and yet chose not to. They couldn't let it go. I thought that was a pretty compelling psychological portrait. Sidney Pollack, however, plays just a very memorable character role. It's hard to identify what it is that makes him so memorable, but when he's on the screen, he's commanding the scene. He is owning it. Everybody else is in there with him, but he's the one in control of the scene and in control of the audience's attention. It's just a really compelling presence to me, and it's amazing that this is a sideline to him. He's a director. He's a big-time director, and yet is able to act in these roles. It's quite impressive to me.
Yeah, I like that movie a lot as well, and I like Pollock. I was almost tempted to pick his performance in Eyes Wide Shut. My number four pick is John Huston, the great director of movies we've talked about a lot, like The Maltese Falcon and Treasure of the Sierra Madre, gave a really unforgettable role late in his career and his life in 1974's film Chinatown by director Roman Polanski. Now, Huston's father was a noted actor. He stars in his son's Treasure of the Sierra Madre. John Huston didn't do a ton of acting, but he's really unforgettable in this film here until the kind of chilling final scene when, well, you don't want to spoil that for you if you haven't seen it, but man, Huston's performance here is perfect as this kind of older patriarch, and he plays that kind of typical noir character in a sense, this well-connected businessman who is not all that he appears and just happy to walk on the wrong side of the law when it suits his needs. And I don't know, there's something really, really creepy and effective about his performance. Chinatown is, of course, a really classic film. I think we talked about it quite a bit when we talked about neo-noir and noir in general. It's one of my favorite noirs and far and away Polanski's best film. And kind of a weird but fitting in that Huston, who helped inspire the entire noir setting or genre, whatever you want to call it, does such a good job here helping to perform in one of the first major neo-noir films.
Yeah, he understood the genre. You can't argue that he didn't, and he just fit right in. That's a great performance. I can't believe I didn't think of it myself. I did, however, think of Roman Polanski himself in Chinatown, who plays just a very quick part, but a very, very memorable one. Number four for me, comedy is just tragically underrated. It looks easy. It is not. It is quite difficult, but when people recognize great performances, they seem to go for the ones that are just obviously dramatic and emotionally powerful. They don't go for the subtle and the funny. So I had to go for something funny here, and of course I had to pick my favorite actor, director, writer, that would be Buster Keaton, and I'll just pick his performance from The General, just kind of arbitrarily because it's his best film, but he is uniformly excellent in all his work. He directed himself almost in every performance. There's a couple where he didn't, but most of his movies he directs as well and writes. And that is amazing, really. I mean, we hear about actor, writer, directors, but if you are directing yourself, and this is one thing to understand about all our picks of directors directing themselves, you don't have a safety net. You don't have a director to tell you, hey, this isn't working. You have to know. And what is amazing about Buster Keaton is his comic timing and his attitude. What he projected was pitch perfect every single time. Now, he did co-direct some of his films, so he had a couple of collaborators over the years, but even so, I think it's clear that he has the creative control in his early films before he signed on with MGM. He has creative control, and he is in charge of his performance.
of course, he knew it so well because he grew up in vaudeville and as a kid, as part of a family act, and he got to know what got laughs and what didn't. He had the audience right there, and so he had all this practice so that when he goes to film and directs himself, so he doesn't have somebody looking over him, and he doesn't have the immediate feedback of the audience, well, he was prepared for that. Nevertheless, explaining his genius does not impugn it at all. He was a master, and I don't think we'll see his like ever again.
And not only, you know, was the guy acting and directing, but he was also, I think, half the time coordinating the stunts, obviously doing his own stunts, and a real master of, like, various mechanical things as well. Really technical guy. I can't imagine how busy he must have been on the sets of his films.
And really.
Not to mention they didn't shoot at the slow pace of modern Hollywood either. I mean, can't even imagine the breakneck speed that Keaton, well, technically, I guess one of the times he did break his neck working on a film, so I guess he really was literally working on a breakneck speed. Well, I tried not to slant too heavily toward actors on this list who become directors, but there are a couple that I think we have to recognize just because, like somebody like Keaton, they're as respected, at least among critics, as respected for the films they direct as they are for their acting. And Clint Eastwood has really, over the last 25, 30 years, become one of those people. And he has a whole list of great performances to pick from in his own movies. But my favorite is from a movie that we're going to talk about a little bit more next week when we talk more about Westerns, and that is the film Unforgiven. This is, you know, so perfectly the role for Clint Eastwood, who helped bring in the Western anti-hero. Here he helps really do a sort of retrospective look at the anti-hero, and everything is wonderful and understated. I mean, Clint is the master at understatement. I think the guy can say more by squinting. I think I heard someone say that recently. Clint could do more by squinting than most actors could do anything else. So that's a guy who can deliver so much with so little. And I've probably mentioned on the show before, though, that he delivers one of my all-time favorite movie lines and just a wonderful scene as he directs himself, and he just utters the words, "Deserve ain't got nothing to do with it." And, oh, man, it's chilling and effective and wonderful and such a memorable, perfect, dark, and really introspective performance. I think it's interesting that, especially when really great directors cast themselves in parts that are interesting. Obviously, this is a part that's sort of made for Clint, but he's not really 100% good guy here. He is kind of an anti-hero, but there's so much depth and complexity that he brings to the role. So unforgettable. So Clint Eastwood's Unforgiven.
Great pick. I think if I had gone with Eastwood and I did consider a number of his roles, I might have been tempted to do Million Dollar Baby. But
that would be my second pick for sure.
Yeah. Unforgiven, though, as well. Very complex character and admirable work. Number three for me, well, he was an actor first, I guess, but maybe he was a writer, actually. I'm not even sure. But it's Woody Allen, and he started out as a stand-up comic and a playwright. Eventually, he got into Hollywood selling his scripts, and then as a star in other people's work, and then finally he got to direct his own movies, and he really hasn't done too much acting outside of his own movies since. One that really stands out for me would be his performance in Husbands and Wives. You've got two couples, and I'm, you know, if this title sounds familiar, I just mentioned it. Sidney Pollack is one of the men in one of these couples, and Woody Allen is the husband in the other couple, and it's sort of a parallel study of these two marriages. One seems to be falling apart, one seems to be really good, and they're mutual friends, and so their relationship struggles affect each other as well, but mostly it's a study of marriage kind of in parallel, two different aspects of two different marriages. And it's pseudo-documentary in style. It's actually a little disorienting. The beginning has some handheld shots in what look like they should be more polished areas. I mean, why is a handheld shot in a closed living room, a very private area where these four people are having a conversation that they'd never have in front of anybody else? The handheld camera makes it look like there's a fifth person in there observing, but I don't know, it kind of works, actually. And there are interspersed throughout the film interview segments where one or the other actors faces the camera and sort of narrates to it. Woody Allen experimented with this in Annie Hall to great effect, but man, those parts of Husbands and Wives where Woody Allen is interviewing himself, essentially, just astonish me in how revealing and personal they are. It's a very personal film. You get the sense that even though he's made many movies about the subject of marriage before, this one is extra intimate for him.
Now, I haven't seen the film. How much does Allen differ from the sort of Woody Allen character? We talk about Tarantino and Scorsese kind of being characters. In a way, Allen is too, I feel like, a little bit.
Does definitely have his quirks. I think one of the things about Husbands and Wives is that you can sense that there's a real character there. And in fact, I think most of his movies, for me, I can sense that there's a real character there and not just a collection of quirks. Definitely you cannot have a Woody Allen character without the quirks, but he's not just putting himself in as a supporting character, a character actor. He is the star, and as such, his character is as developed as it needs to be. So maybe that's the difference. Of course, if one annoys you, then that's it.
You know? Well, one second. I find Tarantino extremely annoying, except in Pulp Fiction.
Okay, so there's an exception.
Yeah. Well, let's take another change of tone here and go back to pre-World War II France and talk about one of the great early directors, Jean Renoir, who directed in the 1930s two of the greatest films ever made, in my opinion, Grand Illusion in 37, and then in 1939, right on the cusp of World War II, directed The Rules of the Game. Renoir himself was not really much of an actor. I think he's got some other small parts, really primarily a director, and here he's directing himself. He plays the character Octave, and trying to explain, first of all, the plot of the film is ridiculous, because it's largely feels like a French farce, and that there's all these different relationships that are being entangled, but there's a little bit of an element of tragedy and drama to it, and all of it is really a metaphor for French society on the eve of what's obviously becoming this giant war, and it's this ridiculously complex web of character interactions and relationships, and everything has more than one meaning. It's got a very sort of feel to it where, yeah, it's enjoyable on this one level, sort of as a light comedy with a little bit of romance and tragedy built into it. But on the other hand, it has a lot to say about society and class. And probably the best example, if you've seen the Robert Altman film Gosford Park, it was heavily influenced by Rules of the Game, some kind of ideas with a murder and all these different upstairs, downstairs type stuff. Well, here Renoir plays a really interesting character. He's allegedly the best friend of the character who I guess is closest to the hero. The world of Renoir, there aren't really heroes and villains exactly. There's just sort of just a bunch of guys, to quote somebody else. But in a sense, we get the feeling that this guy, though he is the character Octave, is mired in his own set of relationship entanglements and, you know, bad relationship choices. He kind of stands above and beyond the rest of the characters. And Renoir is interesting in that he really doesn't seem to be judging his characters harshly at all. And we get the sense that his character, who stands a little bit removed from it, is a real substitute for the director. Now, it's a tricky performance because he's not better than they are, but in any sense. We just get the feeling that he's observing them a little more closely, maybe, than they are observing themselves. And he's not being judgmental. He's maybe pointing out their quirks and making light of it sometimes. But like the director himself, he has a great sympathy for everyone else around him. And I really like that understated performance. It would be easy for Renoir to kind of ham it up a little bit, or maybe to go the other direction and make himself the one wise man who can't be part of any of this nonsense that their characters are getting themselves into. But he doesn't. He goes with it, and it's a perfect, very, very memorable performance.
That's a great pick. I am ashamed to say I didn't think of it. Good call. I'm glad you did that. I think you did think also of my number two pick. I suspect it's going to be your number one, because I don't know how you would leave it off, but it's I picked for my number two François Truffaut in his movie Day for Night. Now, Truffaut, we've talked a lot about. We don't need to go into a whole lot, but his movie Day for Night is about the making of a movie, and Truffaut plays the director of this fictional movie that's being made. a key decision in his performance for me that is so impressive is that the director he plays is substantially less talented than he is himself. And the movie he's making, not ambitious at all. He's trying to make a movie. He's not trying to make a great movie. And I think Truffaut was always trying for some artistic excellence. Whether or not he was pretentious about it, I don't know in real life. But in this movie, the character he plays is just trying to make it through a shoot in one piece. And only a director, I think, could play this as well as he does, because you get a real sense that the director is a lonely person on a set, despite being surrounded by people that are always coming up and asking him questions again and again. Questions, questions, questions. But he is more or less on his own. He has to deliver this film, and ultimately it's his responsibility, and that sets him apart from everybody around. And so I think that sense is conveyed just really well in the movie Day for Night, and so that's why he's my number two.
Wow, I forgot about that.
No way!
Yeah, you know, it was weird. I thought about Truffaut, of course, and all I could think of was his performance in
Close Encounters
of the Third Kind, which I thought, eh, that's not that... I mean, it's kind of a fun role, but nothing that interesting to me. How did I forget Day for Night? Day for Night is one of my favorite... Okay, well, these lists are harder to do than you think sometimes. My number one pick, though, an easy one. You went with Keaton. I went with Chaplin, and I'm not going to even pick a movie because, I mean, we're talking about Chaplin's the Tramp character. Sort of like Keaton, Chaplin got his start working in other people's films, particularly a whole bunch of shorts. But most of his features, especially a little bit later on, are movies that he directed. And Chaplin, like Keaton, he wrote them, he directed them, he edited them, he produced them. He even scored the music, which is impressive since his films were all silent. But one of those guys who did everything. Just amazing how much he did and created what might very well be the single most famous of all movie characters. I don't know. I mean, I guess Mickey Mouse, we talked about before, is probably the most famous. And I don't think you can do that just by putting on a funny outfit and a weird hat and a funny little mustache. Chaplin was able to really, really imbue that character with something special. I mean, there are so many other famous silent characters that we don't remember today, and I think it's a testament to Chaplin's wonderful ability acting and also tremendous ability directing. I mean, as you watch his films, he starts off in these, you know, silly silent comedies, little shorts and stuff, and if you watch his features, they become progressively more and more complex, leading up to his just absolute masterpieces in the late 20s and throughout the 1930s. Just a tremendous director as well. You know, like I think I said about Keaton, Chaplin is absolutely respected as much as being a director, if not more than he is as being an actor, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I definitely would have had Chaplin on my list, and Buster Keaton would have been number one if I had been saying, well, how great are these directors, or even how great are the performances to an extent, but I wanted to reserve my top two for performances that really impressed me because they were from directors that didn't normally act at all. And so I picked Truffaut. My number one is going to be Spike Lee in Do the Right Thing. Now, Spike Lee... sorry to say, he's not a guy that endears me to him outside of the movies. In interviews and things, it just rubs me the wrong way. But in his movies, it's a totally different story, especially in Do the Right Thing. This is unquestionably his greatest film. Very objective, actually. It's surprising how objective it is. It's a day, a very hot day in the inner city in New York, and it's primarily a black neighborhood, but there are other ethnicities present as well, and about how they all interact. And the heat is quite literal. This is a real pressure cooker situation where eventually something is going to snap and there's going to be violence. We just don't quite know where it's coming from. There's a lot of volatility in the characters and the way they interact, a lot of abrasive personalities. People that would probably be just fine in other circumstances, or if they didn't get hung up on just one or two little things that happen to be around them. I mean, there are characters that are substantially less admirable than others, but for the most part, it's just a bad mix. And it's hard to identify when things finally snap and go wrong. It's hard to identify what caused everything. These are the steps that led up to it. You can kind of follow these little trails. Okay, this led to this, led to this. But then meanwhile, you have this other set of situations that is brewing in parallel, and they sort of collide in interesting ways. It's a very difficult story to deconstruct and say, okay, this is what the moral is. If he hadn't done that, then it would have been fine. It is a morality in play in a sense, but it is a bit more ambiguous and understated, and the viewer is left to think about what the ramifications of the story are for himself. And anyway, Spike Lee plays the main character in this, a guy named Mookie, and he's for a large part an observer. He does interact very actively with a lot of the other characters, but for most of the movie, he's reacting and observing and just kind of witnessing the other characters, and you don't really, really fully know what's going on in his head until the climax of the movie, and then even then you think, well, why did he do that? And you have to go back and think, well, maybe it was like this, maybe it was like that. Part of the point of the movie is that you don't always know. You can't deconstruct these things completely, making the point that racial tension is not a simple matter. And very powerful performance. I mean, this is one of the most powerful movies I know of. It's very difficult to watch. It's very harsh, but fulfilling as well, I think.
Great pick. So let's recap. My top six performances by directors with a whole list of caveats I'm not going to repeat. Number six, Martin Scorsese, his cameo as, I think, Homicidal Passengers, what the IMDb listed as, from his film Taxi Driver. Number five, Quentin Tarantino playing Jimmy in his 1994 film Pulp Fiction. Number four, John Huston from Polanski's 1974 film Chinatown. Number three, Clint Eastwood in his own Unforgiven. Number two, Jean Renoir playing the character Octave in his film Rules of the Game in 1939. And number one, Charlie Chaplin playing Little Tramp in pretty much all of his movies.
And my number six, John Cassavetes in The Dirty Dozen. Number five, Sidney Pollack in Changing Lanes. Number four, Buster Keaton in The General, or really anything he directed. And actually, he's my favorite director that we've talked about on this segment. Number three, Woody Allen in Husbands and Wives. Number two, Francois Truffaut in Day for Night. And Stephen would have had him on his list, but he didn't think of it. Number one, Spike Lee in Do the Right Thing. Howard Hawks was one of the great American film directors of the studio system. I had a film class where the professor introduced Hawks this way. He said, "What was the greatest hard-boiled detective picture? Probably The Big Sleep. Now, what was the greatest screwball comedy? Well, His Girl Friday. What was the greatest classic gangster flick? Probably Scarface. What was the greatest Western? Well, there are a few candidates, but one of them is Red River. Now, what do all these films have in common? They were all directed by Howard Hawks. Now, even if you don't agree with those picks, I mean, in fact, I don't. My favorite screwball comedy isn't His Girl Friday, but rather Bringing Up Baby. But you know what? That's directed by Hawks as well. So the point is, he has a lot of heavy hitters on his resume, and it's also a very diverse resume. And, you know, consequently, he's hard to pin down, hard to talk about. Leonard Maltin called Howard Hawks the greatest American director who is not a household name. Because his movies are so diverse, it's hard to talk about overall themes. You talk about Hitchcock, well, everybody knows what you're talking about. But the one thing I guess you could say is that he is a master of genre pictures. Whatever the genre happened to be, he understood what made different types of stories work and produced masterpieces in a lot of them. And here's another kind of amusing thing to me. If you asked him about his theories of filmmaking or storytelling or whatever, he would give you the most wonderfully short and no-nonsense answers. I mean, what constitutes a good movie? Well, three good scenes and no bad ones. That's a good movie, by Howard Hawks' definition. What makes a good director? Well, he said, somebody who doesn't annoy you. That would be a good director. So his first movie came out in 1926, but he actually had a pretty interesting life before that. He was a race car driver. He designed aircraft. Don't confuse him with Howard Hughes, another big-time movie guy who was also an aviator. I guess if you're named Howard in Hollywood, you have to fly. But he got his start with silent films, so it didn't really make a huge splash until the sound era. His earliest great film is probably Scarface from 1932, which stars Paul Mooney. Actually, speaking of Howard Hughes, Hughes produced this one, Hawks directed it. But it caused quite a controversy over its violence. It was a scandalous movie, had to be cut, and the censors forced some additions to the story to kind of drive home that violence is bad, and including it added a subtitle, The Shame of the Nation, so the full title is Scarface, The Shame of the Nation, just so you know that being a violent gangster is a bad thing. But actually, it probably didn't work because Al Capone, I guess, actually loved this movie and got his own copy of it and everything. But do you remember how we were talking about Jean-Luc Godard, one of the French New Wave guys, maybe you don't remember. They were critics before they became directors, and Godard said that Scarface was the best American sound film. So that's pretty high praise. So Hawks did about 15, 16 films during the 1930s, varying kinds, varying quality. In 1934, he made an early Preston Sturges screenplay about the theater called 20th Century, which is one of these frenetic, fast-paced comedies, and it's considered a minor classic. One I liked, but not actually that much. I don't think the characters seem to be genuinely thinking and feeling the way they do in a lot of screwballs, but it's not bad. And a few years later, he would direct Bringing Up Baby, my all-time favorite, Cary Grant and Katharine Hepburn, and we've talked about it a lot, so I'm just going to skip on. I do think it is one of the funniest movies of all time. And so speaking of Cary Grant, he'd make two more with him right in a row. Next was Only Angels Have Wings, one of the best movies about flying ever made, and certainly has some spectacular flying sequences in it, and a good character-oriented story. And in 1940, he returns to screwball comedy with His Girl Friday with Rosalind Russell. You may know the story better as The Front Page, or maybe not, as this is the best adaptation on film of that. And, well, suddenly we're changing gears again, and his next movie is Sergeant York. And you probably recognize the title, even if you haven't seen it. I mean, it's one of those movies that survives the ages, like The Wizard of Oz. You know, people know what it is, whether they've seen it or not. A favorite with a lot of people. It's based on a real guy, Sergeant Alvin York. He was the most decorated soldier of World War I. And he was approached for a while, actually, before this, about having his experiences adapted to film, but he didn't want to do it. When World War II broke out, he said, okay, but as long as Gary Cooper plays me. So that's actually how that happened. It wouldn't have been Cooper otherwise. Cooper worked for a different studio, and they had to cut a deal to trade actors. But, you know, there we go. A war movie, another genre Hawks has conquered. So he continues working with Gary Cooper with Ball of Fire the same year, with Barbara Stanwyck as this singer tangled up with the mob. It's another comedy. And co-written by Billy Wilder. So obviously Hawks is getting top pick of scripts here at this point, if he's directing Sturges and Wilder scripts. And he also did a lot of work on the scripts himself, like Alfred Hitchcock did, but he didn't really take credit for it most of the time. So yeah, he's also working with top actors. Multiple movies with Cary Grant and Gary Cooper. Next up is Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall. Obviously a legendary pairing. We've talked about how great they were together before. They made four movies together, and Howard Hawks directed them in the two best ones, including their first pairing in To Have and Have Not. In fact, that was Lauren Bacall's first movie, so Hawks played a really big part in making her a star. I think that it's easy enough to assume that Bacall, having the great talent she has, would have been discovered at some point, but I don't know if it would have been so instant, because the type of character she plays, and plays so well in that movie, is a kind of character Hawks specialized in. This is worth talking about. It's one of those few universal things with him. He loved women who were tough and unflinching and able to hold their own against men, especially in the area of dialogue. There's a lot of great dialogue scenes in Hawks movies between men and women, whether it's the sexual tension of Bogart and Bacall in To Have and Have Not, or the comedic banter of Cary Grant and Rosalind Russell in His Girl Friday. It's the Hawksian woman that is being displayed here. And, you know, that fits pretty well with the world of Raymond Chandler, so it's not much of a surprise that his next movie is going to be The Big Sleep, and that's such a great one. We talked about that a lot. Okay, so his next movie is Red River. Now, up to this point, Hawks hasn't done much in the way of westerns. It's just like he woke up one morning and said, hey, I'm going to make a western, and it's going to be one of the best westerns of all time. Also, one of the best performances by the number one western star, John Wayne. We talked about this in our movie dads list, actually, our top six movie dads. Even though Wayne's character is more of a surrogate father than a biological one, this is really a brilliant psychological portrait of fatherhood gone wrong, really. The conflict of the characters here, the great tension brewing under the surface, it's just so intense. And the story takes place on a very difficult cattle drive, so people's tempers are short anyway. A great raw, gritty film here about character conflict and dark in a lot of ways. And on the heels of that, he makes a happy little Danny Kaye musical. A song is born, actually a remake of his own film, Ball of Fire. So, it's another interesting situation where he remakes his own film, and we'll get another example in a minute. But then he does I Was a Male War Bride, returning to screwball comedy in Cary Grant in 1949, and then get another shift of pace again. He does this great science fiction monster movie, The Thing from Another World. Sort of. It's actually tough to know how much of this he directed. He definitely produced it, but the credited director is a guy named Christian Nyby, and people think Hawks took over for Nyby at some point for some reason. It's a bit of an unknown. Nyby himself actually credits Hawks as being sort of the force behind the movie. But then James Arness, one of the members of the cast, says, well, yeah, but Nyby was the guy really making the movie. Who knows who did it? Hawks was clearly influencing the movie, though. And this is more of a B-movie, an upscale B-movie, but it's still a good movie. And so, again, I can imagine Hawks kind of sitting around thinking, well, what do I do now? Done a lot of things. We've got Grant, Hepburn, Cooper, Stanwyck, Bogart, Bacall, and Wayne for stars. And I know, I'll help define Marilyn Monroe. So he makes a couple of movies with Monroe, who's a rising star at the time. The first one, actually a bit more of a vehicle for Cary Grant and Ginger Rogers. It was called Monkey Business, and that's a good, funny screwball. But then he makes the musical Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, which teams up Jane Russell and Marilyn Monroe and contains one of the most famous production numbers of all time, where Monroe sings Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend. If you remember the scene in Moulin Rouge where Nicole Kidman sings this, it's not just the same song, it's the similar staging as well. It's very definitely a direct homage to this movie. But Gentlemen Prefer Blondes is a lot more than that as well, I think. It's a tremendous amount of fun and a great mix of lavish musical spectacle and some crazy screwball comedy stuff on top of that. So that's a favorite of mine, even if it's, maybe not the comedic masterpiece that some of his earlier ones are. It's a whole lot of fun. And also, yes, trivia note here, Monroe's characters in those two movies are named Lois Laurel and Lorelei Lee. That's fun to say, Lois Laurel, Lorelei Lee. Again, I can imagine at this point Hawks sitting around thinking, what haven't I done? I know, one of those humongous Roman epics. So he does a movie called Land of the Pharaohs. And this time it's not actually a masterpiece of the genre, but what is a masterpiece of the genre is Rio Bravo, made in 1959. Stephen, what do you think of Rio Bravo? This is one of your favorite director's favorite movies, right?
Yeah, are you talking about Quentin Tarantino?
I would be talking about Quentin Tarantino.
Yeah, I love Quentin Tarantino, and he loves Rio Bravo, which is good because I also love Rio Bravo.
The one interesting thing I remember is it's like a zombie movie without zombies. I mean, what's that about?
Well, it's basically a couple of guys hold up against a whole bunch of other people. What's that's like Dawn of the Dead or something, where you get the one couple people in this small location while seemingly everyone else in the universe is out to get them. Here, it's great. I like the way they mix some of the drama with some decent comedy. I don't know what it is. This is kind of something you see in a couple different Westerns. You know, the one guy versus a million. You think of High Noon or the recently remade 310 to Yuma, where it's just one or two people versus an entire town. And yeah, there is something that's always kind of cool about that. You know, how can you possibly hold up against these overwhelming odds? But of course, our heroes usually find a way to do it.
Yeah, and speaking of High Noon, that's actually a point I want to make here is, and I think we've made it before, but High Noon is sort of a defense of cooperating with the House Un-American activities during the McCarthy era when the government and the studios themselves as well were trying to root out communists from Hollywood. And so High Noon kind of is a movie that is a Western, but it's really about the contemporary issues of the day, and hey, you know, it is difficult when you are alone and there's nobody who's willing to help you, even your friends. And so that was seen as one kind of statement about that, and Rio Bravo was made as sort of an attack on High Noon. It was like, yes, we know it's difficult, but you know, you gotta do what you gotta do, be a man and do it, and quit your whining about it. I think that's why I like Rio Bravo a little better than High Noon, but interesting movie to be made in that context. And actually, Hawks would keep coming back to Rio Bravo, sort of. I mean, in 66, he sort of remade it as El Dorado, and that had John Wayne and Robert Mitchum, and that's, I think, almost as great, in some ways, maybe better. And then his last movie, Rio Lobo, was sort of, but not quite, a sequel to El Dorado. I'm not really sure about the relationship of these movies, but anyway, that was in 1970. But earlier on, let's go back a bit to the early 60s, John Wayne again. One of the most interesting and unique movies I know, called Hatari. One of the reasons it's so enjoyable is because there isn't anything else like it. It's about a crew of people who, as a living, capture animals in Africa and ship them around the world to zoos. So you want a rhinoceros? Well, you hire these guys to get out in their jeeps and speed over the African plains and get one. The photography is just incredible. Right from the opening scenes, you get these just amazing, suspenseful scenes where John Wayne is strapped to the hood of a moving vehicle, bouncing around really fast where there are no roads or anything, and alongside these million-pound wild animals that occasionally like to just headbutt your truck and knock it over. I've never seen anything like this. It's really visceral filmmaking, and you can tell special effects and trick photography is involved, but so much of it looks very authentic. And it's just a huge adrenaline rush and fun because of how outrageous it is. And then, you know, you got that moment, and then the next, it's this mellow little comedy drama where they're back in their home, away from home, more or less, and animal cages all around them. And you get these light little misadventures and some romantic comedy as well, when a woman shows up to report on their activities, and the men, you know, do and don't want her there. There's no place for a woman, but gosh, you're pretty. That kind of thing. And fun animal stuff in here. Just a great animal movie, you know. They're capturing him for zoos, which isn't that politically correct anymore, but the movie is, or at least seems, pretty knowledgeable about how to handle animals and is interested in their welfare. But it's just a wonderful setting for a lot of different types of stories to unfold that relate to this situation. And I also want to mention his next movie, Man's Favorite Sport, 1964, because we're well out of the era of screwball comedy now, but hopefully you figured out that this is one genre he likes to keep returning to, and he does it again with Rock Hudson and Paula Prentice, and makes it work really nicely in the social mindset, the social values of the 60s, which are obviously going to be dramatically different from, say, the 40s, but he still makes that genre work in that context. So even though that's not a great movie, it is a very good one. So Hawks is a neat guy. He's made a lot of just masterpieces, and then some of his second-tier movies are maybe not masterpieces, but just as interesting in their own way. So Hawks is a guy to seek out. If chances are I've mentioned a few that you might have seen anyway, but certainly the others are worth seeking out. Some I skipped over that I haven't seen and I want to seek out, just because he doesn't seem to make a bad movie, really, ever.
I think what's interesting about Hawks is, like you said, you know, the incredible diversity that the guy brings across. You know, you opened up with, oh, he made the best hard-boiled detective movie, the best one of the best screwball comedies, best this and that, and not many directors today, I think, have this kind of range. So one of the cool things about Hawks is if you kind of go through his filmography, you really get some of the absolute great American films. So if you're not familiar with Hawks, I would definitely recommend picking up, you know, putting a bunch of his movies in your Netflix queue or whatever, and just going through them, because you'll get almost a crash course in the great American studio films.
Yeah, and you wouldn't get burnt out on seeing the same kind of movie at all. This is just, you just get a good cross-section of the era. You know, he helped define filmmaking for a few decades.
Okay, so we're back with the answer to today's trivia question, which was to identify what is unique or strange about the 1938 Western, The Terror of Tiny Town, directed by Sam Neufeld. Do you have any idea, Sam?
It is the only movie in history that has a four-word title. It all start with T, every word.
I doubt that's... It's actually
I don't think there's any others.
It's actually a five-word title, The Terror of Tiny Town.
Oh, there's an of in there.
Yeah.
Well, crud!
Yeah.
Is the only... Okay. Only title in cinema history with the acronym TTOTT.
I somehow doubt that's the case as well. I don't know firsthand, but I'm willing to bet that it's not.
All right, I give up. I get it wrong.
Well, it's the only Western with every person in the cast under 4 feet tall. Kind of notable for that. They ride around on Shetland ponies instead of horses, and they're roping calves. Probably not the sort of thing that you could get made today. Not very...
What?
Yeah. Not particularly politically correct, but a strange, bizarre footnote in the history of the Western. Yeah, according to the Wikipedia entry, there's gags such as the cowboys walk into the saloon by ducking under the swinging doors rather than walking through them. And yeah, sounds like a very strange movie. I've not seen it, but there you go.
I'm sure that's first in the list to be revived somehow.
Absolutely. That wraps things up, but never fret, we've got one more episode coming up, and in the meantime, you can always check out the website at allmovietalk.com. That's the name of the show, allmovietalk.com, where we've got all sorts of great discussions and comments about the episodes and other cool stuff about movies.
And, yeah, that's episode 52 coming out, right? I like to call it All Movie Talk Pickup. moving on. All right, well, next week, anyway, in our episode 52, we're going to talk about modern Westerns to complement our talk about classic Westerns this week, and I'm going to be a little cagey about what else we're going to talk about, because it is, after all, our last episode. Got to make it special. We will, however, talk about a couple of French guys, one of them whom probably isn't really French. And for our last segment, you know, last episode, last segment, Steve and I thought really hard about what is it that would just be the perfect thing to talk about. What have we both been dying to talk about? What's going to be a great segment to go out on? And we came up with Underdog. So that'll be next week, episode 52.
Pew! Oh, you weren't supposed to actually shoot me. Cut.